There is someone here tonight who I would like to turn the meeting over to, who knows tonight's speaker a little bit well than probably anybody in the room. And with that, I'd like to introduce Max.
Hi, my name is Max. I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. I'm not going to talk, but I just want to tell you that Paul says I give the perverted version of his story when it's true. But I like to remind everyone that I was the one that was sober. And I've worked hard to keep him sober. That's all I'll say. And Paul?
Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm an enthusiastic alcoholic. Thank you for that introduction, Max. Not the shortest introduction I've ever had. One time I was introduced as somebody saying, "Here's Paul." And I'm glad to be here. I love this kind of meeting. I love meetings wherein there are too many people for the room. No matter what the size of the room is, just so it's too small for the number of people, because you jam alcoholics together like this, they generate a great deal of energy, love, enthusiasm, and I love enthusiasm. I'm very enthusiastic about this way of life. I'm enthusiastic about this program. I'm enthusiastic about sobriety. Anybody's sobriety, especially my own. I'm even enthusiastic about the word enthusiasm. As I understand it, the en means within, and theos means God, and it means the God within. And my higher power is, it likes it when I'm enthusiastic about what he has done with what I gave him to work with. I like enthusiasm. I like enthusiastic people. Even if somebody's doing something wrong, if they're doing it with enthusiasm, I like it. You know, I always feel bad to look around and see people having to stand. Though I feel sorry about that. And but then a little voice says, "What the hell? You've got to stand." And I'm enthusiastic about the chip people and the birthdays. A lot of birthdays. Happy birthday. I think that's great. And the court cards. I didn't get to count the court cards. I like to count the court cards. I was at a meeting up near Riverside one night, and it must have been close to a court or something like that. They had 20, I counted them, they had 20 court cards and only one newcomer. I always like to welcome the non-alcoholic drunk drivers. We're really glad you're here. And I hope you stay here till I get back to my hotel. I particularly want to welcome the newcomers. That we're always glad to see newcomers. That's called carrying the message. Of course, anything you do at an AA meeting, just sitting, filling a chair and not talking to anybody, you're still carrying the message. You're helping to make a meeting, an AA meeting survive. And carrying the message, I read the other day that Bill W., one of our co-founders, said that carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was our chief aim and our primary purpose. For living. Yeah, chief aim and primary purpose for living. And I thought, God, those are strong words. And when he says our, was he talking about us as individuals or us as groups or both? And so that carrying the message is pretty big deal. And we like particularly to carry it to newcomers. We carry it to each other because we need it continually and continuously and on, but we also particularly like to give it to newcomers, and so we're really glad you're here. And we're always glad to see newcomers. In fact, we're so glad to see the newcomers that we don't even care if you're not glad that you're here. In fact, if you are happy, if you're just delighted to be here, you're just happy, 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 and you just think if nothing you'd rather do than do this every night for the rest of your life, and you're so happy you can't stand it, we may not be able to help you. But if you perchance think your case is different and you think you're different, then it may be okay for us, but not for you. That you're different from us. If you have that conviction that you're different, you're right. You are. You are different. And in fact, if you feel different, look around the room, and you probably, undoubtedly, will not find anybody that looks just like you. And there's no two of us alike. Never have been two people exactly alike. The same appearance, the same thoughts, the same actions, the same feelings. No two of us are exactly the same. Never have been. And we're each of us little snowflakes. Everybody's different. And as a matter of fact, if there are two of us exactly alike, one of us would be unnecessary. So, if you think you're different, you're right. You are different. But if you look around, or if you listen to stories, you pay attention, you'll find out, really, that we're more alike than we are different. We're more alike than we are different. And the reason that's important is if you look for the similarities, you're very likely to stay sober. And if you keep looking at the differences, you're very likely to keep on getting drunk. And you may find out if you start looking for the similarities, you may find out we're not too bad after all. Maybe a little silly at times, but that's okay. We need to laugh every so often. I suddenly realized I'm standing here talking about how wonderful this whole life is and how great AA is and how much I really love it. In fact, I love AA so much that I am absolutely delighted to be an alcoholic. I like being an alcoholic. I like being out here. People say they like the program, but they certainly don't like being an alcoholic. And when I hear that, I think, what the hell could the program be if you weren't an alcoholic? I'm delighted to be an alcoholic. And if it bothers you to hear me say that, it's too damn bad. If you don't understand it, go ask your sponsor. If your sponsor doesn't understand it, get a new sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, shame on you. And it's odd that I am so enthusiastic about being an alcoholic when I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. It wasn't very funny either. It was rather sad, as a matter of fact. I had a brain tumor, and they missed it. What are you laughing about? There's nothing funny about a brain tumor. In fact, they missed it so badly that I ended up on the nut ward. They missed my brain tumor. I ended up on the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. That was a boring place to be, too. They were a funny place. They were fanatics on this making leather belts. It was very much a part of the program. You had to make a leather belt. In fact, I don't think you could graduate until you made a leather belt or an ashtray or something really useful. And they used to nag about it. The place I was at, they nagged about making these leather belts. And they were really fussing about it. And the whole philosophy was based on that. And they tried to tell me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belts. And I have a whole wall with licenses and certificates and diplomas and papers to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence. And I didn't see how knowing how to make leather belts would improve my life in any capacity. And I didn't understand the philosophy. And besides, I didn't understand the instructions. Well, that wasn't my fault. That was the fault of that dumb occupational therapist. It was. I've always known that if you don't understand a thing well enough so you can explain it to me so I understand it, then you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. And this stupid girl had explained it 3 times. And I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. I remember sitting there in the nut ward commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes and misdiagnoses and poor medical management and lousy care and bad breaks that a nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't see that my problems were strictly marital walked up behind me and he asked me, he said, would you mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, God almighty, Doc, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? You know? But I'll tell you, I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And you may not know this, but happiness on a nut wart is having a happy psychiatrist. And in order to make him happy, I said yes. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, my name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic. I was embarrassed for him. Here he is meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he talks about is that he's an alcoholic. I was a lot more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. And loud voice. My God, his voice was loud. He kept talking about us drunks and us Alcoholics Anonymous and our big book in Alcoholics Anonymous and us drunks and alcoholics and all that. That's all he could talk about, energy. Shouting. I thought to myself, my God, man, these people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that? You know. And his story went on and on and on and on and on. It was interminable. And I don't remember a word that he said. I don't remember a word that he said. It was in a loud voice, and it was on forever. And the only thing I remember was in the end that he said, well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it. I won't like it, but I'll go. And because I knew he'd go back and squeal that dumb psychiatrist. We went off to the meeting. I haven't any idea what meeting we went to. I don't know who led, who read, who prayed. I don't remember anything anybody said. I don't even know how many meetings we went to before I knew what meeting we were at. But I know that meeting had a profound effect. It had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He was delighted. And that's all he could talk about now. He says, what's this about meetings? He says, what's this about steps? What's this about a book? How many steps are there? How often do they have meetings? What other kind of meetings do they have? How soon are you going to go to the meetings? I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's ending me. My wondering how many meetings I'm going to have to go to before I can get him sober and go home. So I wanted Frank to take me every meeting he could, and Frank was very good. He took me every night, except he was not sure about Friday. He thought on Friday he might have a date with his girlfriend, Carolyn. And I thought, well, that's a hell of a way to run an organization. And I reported him to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist got some other attorney to take me on Friday. Finally got enough meetings, got enough brownie points. I got discharged. They had no intention of coming back. Why would I come back? I wasn't an alcoholic. My problem was that Max had been going to the meetings with us, and she liked the meetings. Of course, once I found out she liked the meetings, I used that against her, because if she wouldn't behave right, I decided I wasn't going to go to AA meetings anymore. I used that once too often, and she couldn't do that. She couldn't drive the freeway, but she got in the car, she drove down, went to the meetings by herself. Have you ever tried sitting home on a Saturday night, drinking, while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? Yeah. I found it boring. I had to go back to the meetings to find out what they're laughing about. And I found out the alcoholics laugh at anything. They laugh at nothing. They just laugh. I sat there listening to them laugh for 7 months. For 7 months. I went to one meeting too many, and I found myself laughing with them, and I haven't had a drink since. The laughter is very therapeutic for me. It's very therapeutic. In fact, I am convinced that my higher power laughs anytime he hears alcoholics or Al-Anons laugh. He laughs too. Even if he doesn't get the joke. The laughter is very spiritual, I find. Very therapeutic. And anyhow, that's how I got to be an alcoholic. I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous things. And what are you laughing about? That's not... The program tells you it's a disease. It's a contagious disease. Highly contagious disease. You get it from other alcohol. I was always raised to believe that alcoholism by drinking alcohol in bars. And that's not... I get drunk drinking alcohol. But I didn't get alcoholism from alcohol. I got it from alcoholics. And in fact, if you're here tonight or this weekend and you're not alcoholic, you want to be very, very, very careful. Indeed. Not funny. It's very serious. If you're here, you want to keep your mind wide open. Wide open. So whatever goes in goes right on through. But if you hear something, you think, my God, I did something. I felt like that when I... You suppose I might be an alcoholic. You're an alcoholic. Yeah. The minute you suspect it, it's too late. And you won't get any sympathy here. You turn to the person next to you, you say, I think I might be an alcoholic. Oh, yeah, another one. Put your hand up. They're glad to infect you, and you think they got a bonus for every new member or something like that. And you don't get alcoholism in bars. There aren't any alcoholics in the bars. Did we have to show the hands of the alcoholics here tonight? All the alcoholics, please raise your hand. Raise your hand. Yeah. Just look. Look at that. We got a real quorum here. I've always been impressed with the number of alcoholics that you see at AA meetings. Try that at a bar sometime, you know. Stop in at the bar and say, I just came from an AA meeting. Run a survey. Will all the alcoholics please raise your hand? You won't get the same response there. No alcoholics in the bars. They're all in the AA meeting. And this is where you get the disease. And my problem was that when I first became alcoholic, I was just barely alcoholic. Just barely alcoholic. I mean, I was hardly, almost a non-alcoholic. And I had to become an alcoholic so I could quit drinking. But just barely alcoholic. But because I had to keep coming back to meetings, because I wanted to be a sober, just barely alcoholic, but because I kept coming back to meetings, I kept getting reinfected. And so today I am much more alcoholic than I was when I first became alcoholic. I mean, I'm getting worse all the time. I'm getting reinfected. In fact, I even developed a bit of a, well, I guess you could call it a bit of a pill problem. I never became an addict or anything like that. I mean, nothing that serious. I mean, I didn't stoop that low. But I did that. I took a few pills, medically indicated pills. But I never abused the pills. That's the thing. You can't ask any doctor how his patients become addicted to prescription pills, and he'll tell you two things. He'll tell you none of his patients ever get addicted to pills. No, he'll tell you that. And the other thing he'll tell you is you can't get hooked on pills unless you abuse them. You have to abuse the pill. Never that the pill abused you. It's always that you abuse the pill. Any doctor will tell you that. And personally, I don't even know how to abuse a pill. How do you abuse a pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know? You stomp on the thing? You verbally abuse it. You jerky, rotten little pill, right? You do it. Never abused a pill in my life. They were little bitty, tiny pills. Just to look at them, you could tell they were very mild and they were very weak. I was even very careful where I carried them. I mean, I put them over with my change, and people say, "You got change for a dollar?" And I say, "Yeah," and I go like that. And they say, "Oh, you carry second all around in the daytime." You know? So I put them over with my keys, and I go get in the car and take the keys out of my pocket. The Quaalude would run down the street, you know. And damn thing would always run faster than I could run, you know. And I didn't dare stomp on it or I'd abuse it. I was very solicitous of my pills, so I never even took a pill unless I had the absolutely precise symptom that only that pill would relieve. I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. So that every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time, prescribed by a doctor, and taken according to directions. Mine, you know. And that's how I became an alcoholic. Anyhow, when I became an alcoholic, I decided I wanted to be one of the sober alcoholics. I wanted to be one of the winners. In fact, I used to hear it all the time. Stick with the winners. Stick with the winners. And I remember thinking, well, if I'm going to stick with the winners, I better find out what a winner is. And I asked Chuck C., who had been sober about 150 years. And I said, what's a winner? And I was surprised that he had to stop and think. And he said, well, I guess you have to die sober. What a big damn deal, yeah. I'd always planned on being a saint. I was going to be the saint. I'd gotten a big book, Lives of the Saints, and wanted to read through it and find out which saint I wanted to be my role model, and I was going to be a saint. I was studying this thing to be a saint, studying for my sainthood, and I remember, I found a final requirement for being a saint was you had to be dead 300 years. I thought, well, screw that. I don't want any glory that you have to die to get. And so I thought, I'm not going to shoot for being a dying winner. I'm going to learn. I'm going to try to live like a winner. And I decided, I changed it to be a successful member of AA. I decided I'm going to be a successful member of AA. That's my goal, Mike. I set that as my goal. I'm going to be a successful member of AA. And over the years, I've changed a little bit in my definition of success, but in general, I've never seen a successful member of AA who drinks. And and I haven't had a drink or a pill now. At the end of July, it'll be 28 years. And you are nowhere near as impressed as I am. Now, I'll tell you what's even more impressive than that is that Max, who introduced me, she drove me to drink for 28 years. And here it is, I've been sober. I'll be 28 years. We've been married for 56, 57 years at the end of this year. I shouldn't give her too much applause because that's how, you know, a lot of people don't know how they got to be an alcoholic. I do. Max and I have known each other for 70 years. Wow, is right, by God. When I was 4 years old, my father gave up his job as a druggist in Canton, Ohio, and without asking my opinion, he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio. And I literally grew up in a drugstore. And right next door to the drugstore was where Grandma Gensfine lived. And Grandma Gensfine was raising her granddaughter, who was an orphan, Maxine. And Grandma Gensfine also had two sons, the Gensfine boys. And they were alcoholics. And in fact, then later on, Max was being raised by an aunt, and the aunt's husband was also an alcoholic. But the point was that the Gensfine boys were periodically getting arrested and put in jail, and would be in the Alliance Review that the Gensfine boys were arrested for common drunk again. And when Max and I were growing up and playing, my family did not like for me to play with the Gensfine girl because they were afraid that when we grew up, we might get married and I might turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right. So I don't know about anybody else, but I know that I'm an alcoholic by marriage. I wasn't an alcoholic when I married her. And once I became an alcoholic, then I decided I was going to be sober. When I decided that I was just going to quit drinking. But that's the only way to be a sober alcoholic is to quit drinking, and I knew that. But I knew that when you quit, you had to quit forever. And I had quit drinking. I have no idea how many times I quit drinking. But every time I quit drinking, I ended up drunk. And I tell you, I got drunk from quitting drinking so many times that I decided that quitting drinking was ruining my health. I finally decided that I need to not drink, but I can't quit. And I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know who to ask. Well, I knew who to ask, but if you ask somebody a question, that proves you're stupid. You don't know the answer, so I wasn't going to ask anybody. But I heard some of these stupid things they say, like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. That's a dumb statement. I've never gotten drunk on one drink. And if you don't drink today, you won't get drunk today. And stupid things like that. Things you tell dummies from Skid Row, but you don't tell a doctor something like that. But I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'm not going to drink today and see what happens. Nothing happened. Yeah. And I decided to try it another day. Yeah. Nothing happened that day. And that's what I've been doing. Today's a very important day for me. Today's the day I don't drink. Yeah. Never drink on Fridays, Thursdays, whatever it is. You know? Just don't drink one day at a time. Drank many yesterday, going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. In fact, I don't know if I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. And when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time. And if it's today, I won't drink today. And that, and having a sponsor, and reading a book, and going to a ridiculous number of meetings, and working the steps over and over again. I've redone all the steps to the best of my ability, an average of every 5 years. And every time I've done that, I moved on to a new plateau in the thing. And I love living by the steps. I say the Serenity Prayer, the third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer on awakening in the morning. Max and I say it together at the breakfast table. We have a period of reading and meditation, and throughout the day, I commonly recite the Serenity Prayer, third step prayer, and seventh step prayer. And I just had a very profound thought, and I lost it. Sure lost, all right. I'll think of it later, but you'll never know. But even the sponsor, we didn't do that right. I was sober a few months or something like that, and the men's stag group was nagging at me because I didn't have a sponsor. And I was talking to Jack, and Jack was sober a month or so longer than I was, and Jack and Wanda, Max and I used to drive her off to speaker meetings together. Went to being spot, and I was telling him how the group was picking on me because I didn't have a sponsor. And on the spur of the moment, I said, Jack, why don't you be my sponsor? He says, well, I'll be your sponsor if you'll be my sponsor. I said, well, I don't know if they allow that. Sounds kind of incestuous to me. So we decided to try it, and he's had to keep working the steps to stay one step ahead of me, and I have to read up on the steps so I can stay one step ahead of him, and I call him because he's my sponsor, and he calls me because I'm his sponsor, so we call each other twice as often, and we're both staying twice as sober. And so we've been, in fact, I haven't talked to him since earlier today. And it's worked well for us, and that's the way it goes. And I don't have any problem today as a result of drinking. I haven't had any problems as a result of drinking since the last time I took a drink. My problems today aren't related to drinking. My problems today are all related to my thinking. In fact, Jack says to me, Paul, don't drink and don't think. I don't even have a problem today, unless I think I do. I have never ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. Yeah. If I think I got a problem, I alone determine whether or not I have a problem. And I alone determine the size of my problem. If I think it's a big problem, it's a big problem. If I think it's just a little problem, it's just a little problem. Doesn't matter what you think. If I think it's a little problem, it's just a little problem. My problem with problems is that whatever I think about, my brain is like a energy factory. A power plant, and it creates all this energy and power, and it puts it out in powerful searchlight or laser beam or ultraviolet light, and it'll go through the dark and then it'll search for something. Oh, that's an interesting problem you've got there. Could I borrow it for a while? You know. And I can take any little problem, and I can take any little problem and just think about it and watch it grow. You know, in fact, I don't even have to start with a problem. I can start with a non-problem. I can say, well, hell, that's no problem. Oh, I suppose if you thought about it, it might be a little bit. And I get to thinking about whether or not it could be a problem. You know? And I pretty soon it's growing, and I get fascinated with, well, my God, this really is a problem, you know. And pretty soon it reaches the point where I'm thinking, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Yeah. And the reason it's a good thing I'm looking at it is because everybody else is missing it, you know. And it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And And then the worst thing that could happen is that my phone will ring, and people will distract me from my problem. So I give out my phone number all the time, so I need the instructions. Well, we live up in the 714 area, up in bankrupt Orange County. And our number is 240-3940, 240-3940. And the phone will ring, and somebody will call with some little piddly problem, you know. And they're distracting me from my big problem, you know. And I think, oh, how could you be upset about such a stupid little problem, you know? But you can't say that to them, my God. You can't say that. I mean, they go around AA and talk about you. And, or worse than that, they might stay sober and get another sponsor and stay sober. So you have to be empathetic. You have to active listening. You have to active listening. That's the big deal among therapists now. It's active listening. You know, there's a couple of therapists over there. What you do is that you ask questions. You see, you are interested, and you say, Oh, and then what did you do? Oh, and how did you feel about that? So, and then what happened? You know? And you keep asking questions. Tell me more. You know, tell me more. You keep asking questions until neither one of you can stand it anymore. You know? And then you give them the answer. And, what's the answer? If you can't think of anything else, just pick a number from 1 to 12. They work that step, you know. They'll disappear, and later on they may come back and say, oh, I got the most wonderful sponsor, you know. Unless you pick that number, what is it, 4 or 5, you know. They may never come back. But if they're not going to work the steps, you don't want to sponsor them anyhow. What can you sponsor them to if they don't want the program? And my experience is that I've never, ever had a problem. I don't now have a problem. I never, ever will have a problem, nor will anybody ever come to me with a problem such that I can't find an answer in the steps. I have found all my answers in the steps. I haven't gone, had to go out to, I don't want to talk against therapy because some people need it. I very recommend it to you. But I haven't personally needed therapy, and I haven't needed any pills of any kind. I'm around pills all the time. I love the fact that I have the program, and I feel that the program's a complete answer for me. The reason I'm getting a little stumbling around right now is that, when I'm talking to you, you're sitting relatively quiet, and I'm focusing on trying to have a straight train of thought. Meanwhile, there are far more people than there are in this room in my head, and the committee that runs my life. And they're up there, and they talk, 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 they talk, they talk, they talk. All day long, all night long, they talk, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk, they talk. That's all they ever do is talk. They never do any work. They just talk. They talk. And I'm trying to focus on what I'm saying, and they make suggestions to what I was talking about. And one will suggest something, and then another one will suggest something. And then somebody else will suggest something else. Then they get to fighting among themselves about what I talk about, and they get shouting back and forth, and it's very distracting to me. And I think, shut up there, you know. And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say, you know. So I have to wait for them to settle down. But that's, I don't know how it is when you think, but when I think, somebody's talking, 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 talking. In fact, Tom, who very graciously invited me to talk here tonight, asked me if I'd like some coffee, and I said no, because I don't even want the caffeine. I don't want caffeine because even that is a chemical. The talk that I have is talk, 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 talk. I get into caffeine and it goes talk, 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 talk. And used to be I was taking amphetamines and all these other pills and I had to take all these pills to control these people in my head. In fact, that's why I've had trouble sleeping all my life. I had to be the last one to go to sleep. In the same way in the morning, I couldn't get up and get going until they got awake and got going. So I was taking things to wake them up, things to calm them down, things to send them to sleep, things to settle them off. And today, I'm amazed at how sensitive they are to chemicals today. I just can't get many. And in fact, it isn't what happens in my life that matters, that determines the quality of my life. It's what they think about what happens. In fact, it's not just what they think about what happens. It's who I listen to up there about what they think. Because they have different personalities. There's somebody up there that he finds fault with everything. No matter what it is, he finds fault with it. I mean, they're perfectionists. He wants everybody else to be perfect. And they complain about everything that goes on. And others up there can accept just about anything. And the same way with my relationship with Max. It isn't what she does that determines how the quality of my relationship with Max. It's who of the people up there I listen to. Actually, there's one up there that has known Max as long as I have known her, and he's been obsessed with her. He watches her, and he reports back to me. And he doesn't particularly approve of her. Yeah. He'll tell me things like, "Did you notice the tone of voice in which he's talking to you? Yeah. Does that woman know who she's talking to?" Yeah. That sort of thing. And yet there's another one up there that's been just as obsessed with her for just as long. And the report back to me, and he thinks she's terrific. He thinks she's got a great sense of humor. She's very spiritual. He likes to remind me that she kept going to AA. She's not even alcoholic. She was going to AA when I didn't want to go, and she's been active in Al-Anon all these years, and blah, 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 all this stuff about how wonderful she is. And my relationship with Max doesn't depend on what she does. It depends on which of the guys up there I listen to. And so who I listen to, it depends. It either gets progressively better or progressively worse. And in fact, the voices in my head, who I listen to determine my attitude. In fact, that's something I heard a lot when I first came to AA, AA stands for altered attitude. AA stands for altered attitude. That was real news to me. I remember a guy one time stood up at the AA podium and said, "Happiness is the absence of unhappiness." I thought, well, I'll be damned, you know. Where did that come from? You know, what a concept. The quality of my life depends on my attitude, and my attitude depends on which of the people in my head I listen to. I have choices. I didn't know I had choices. In fact, I didn't have choices because I didn't know I had a choice. You don't have a choice unless you know you have a choice. And indeed, folks, I've just screwed up your entire future. But any time you are unhappy, from now on, you'll know it's because you're making poor choices of who you listen to in your head. In fact, this whole convention will be... The people have worked like fiends to set this thing up. Thousands of people have worked to make this a great success. And you know, what's the main ingredient for each of us about this weekend is not who did what work. The main ingredient will be our own personal attitude toward what goes on. And what I'm saying is, we're going to have a good time. And if we don't, it's our own goddamn fault. Yeah. Attitude has to do with everything, and it's about 95% of the whole thing. Anyhow, I like to work in the steps and fact, well, one of the things I've been doing with the step that's a little different is the seventh step. In fact, now that I'm sober a while, the sixth and seventh step mean far more to me than they did in the beginning. For instance, I've taken fear and insomnia and depression. I tell you, I love being depressed. I love being depressed. It's always been my favorite emotion, to be depressed. So it has a lot of lots to go for, say for it. I mean, because it, well, you get the life down so much. I mean, get rid of all this crap and use it and focus on yourself. And oh, poor me. And it's very closely akin to self-pity, but for me. And I decided all those things. Well, that was a defective character. And I, with my insomnia and my fear and those things, treated them as defects of character. And I told my higher power, and I said, I became willing to have them removed. Then I asked God to remove it one at a time. But then he has that loophole. Says, please, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Please remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. That is a very big loophole. And I tell God, I know you have that loophole. I'd like you to remove all of this defect, but I know you have that loophole. So you take my defect, you sleep on it overnight, and in the morning, you give me back the amount of that defect you want me to have. And whatever you give me back, I'll accept that as a gift from you. It must be useful to him or my fellows, and so I take it as a gift. And I become, like Father Terry says, you become friendly with your defect. Become friendly with your defect. Become friendly. Laugh at it. Rule 62. Don't work on getting rid of it. Ask God to remove it. Don't ask God to help you get rid of it. Ask God to remove it and accept what he does. In fact, I see it as three things. Be willing to have it removed. Ask to have it removed. Act as if he has. Being friendly with your defects. I remember some poet, he called defects demons. And he said, hug your demon. Hug your demon. Otherwise, it'll bite you in the ass. No, that, I wouldn't talk like that. But you know how poets are. In fact, several years back, somebody was asking me about my health. I said, it's fine. They said, well, I heard you were ill or something. I said, I haven't been ill. They said, yeah, a few years back, you were something about you. And I had cancer. And I forgot all about it. About several years back, I was told that I had cancer of the prostate, and they wanted to chop it out. And I thought, jeez, it's a big C, cancer, and major surgery. You know what minor surgery is? Minor surgery is surgery that somebody else has. I thought, here I'm going to have this major surgery. And it's cancer. I have a problem. And then I thought, no, I don't. No, I don't have a problem. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. He's got a problem. Because my life includes my health. And I knew that he knew that it was his problem. The reason I knew that he knew it was his problem is because way back when I took the third step says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives to the care of God. And the third step prayer says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will, and blah, blah, blah. I had said the third step and the third step prayer on my knees in front of my sponsor. And I thought, well, now if I say the third step prayer and the third step in front of each of my then three home groups, I'll have all those witnesses to this contract. And the only way either one of us can rescind the contract is to get all those people together. I'm going to make it difficult for God to rescind it. And I did that. I went before each of my home groups and I did that. And I thought, that's still not enough. So I went down to a... business supply store, and I bought a blank form for a limited partnership, and I filled it out, and I gave my higher power a 51% controlling interest in my life. I made him the general partner, and I was a limited partner. Then I found out that still wasn't enough. There was one last thing I had to do, and that was, see, that only showed that a limited partnership exists. What we needed now was the terms of the partnership. Who's responsible for what? So that when things come up, you have it in writing as to how it should be handled. So I sat down and drew up the terms of the partnership. What was his responsibility? What was my responsibility? I filled that out. Basically, what it came down to was that he's in charge of worry, and I'm in charge of work. And he doesn't like for me to even help him with the worry. And he never does a damn bit of the work. So I thought, I've heard a lot of good stories about him. I think I'll just sit back and see how he handles this cancer thing now. And he did a great job. He did a great job. I just went through that thing. It turns out that having that medical problem, that surgical problem, going through that was a great spiritual experience. And I think that's, I see that all the time. When we're in pain, and we have a problem, if we don't drink, we either drink or grow, is what I'm saying. If we don't drink, we grow. So that all pain becomes growing pain if we don't drink. And so that we end up on the thing spiritually better off as a result of that. And I'm not recommending you go out and get cancer. And it'd be hard for the women to get it anyway. But anybody's interested after the meeting, I'll show you my scar. I heard a lot about one of the things in AA that has intrigued me is the idea of the of love. Dr. Bob talked about love and service, and I thought that when I was growing up, it was the idea of saying "I love you, I love you," and that's a phrase I don't use very much. Somehow I don't find it real comfortable, just keep saying that. It seems kind of meaningless sometimes. And I've listened to definitions of love around the program. As a matter of fact, I remember one night, didn't seem very late to me, and I called Chuck C. and asked him, I said, what's your definition of love? And he says, it's the same thing at 11 o'clock in the morning as it is at 11 o'clock at night. Oh, jeez, he's a crabby old fool. Yeah. I said, yeah, but what is it? He says, it's action. Bang. And he hung up. And love is action. He always said love is for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. Nothing in return. If you expect anything, even appreciation, it's not love, it's barter. And Don G used to say, love is an active concern for another person's welfare. But somebody said, love is making the other person feel important. Love is making the other person feel important. That raising the other person's self-esteem. And I've been focusing on that. And it seems to me that in the program, our steps and all focus a lot on our defects and our shortcomings and the things that are wrong with us, and an inventory of moral, searching through this moral inventory and checking out on ourselves, which is all good. But I've kind of gotten to where when people call me, most of the time they're distressed about something they've done or distressed about themselves. And I've tried to end the thing, either end the conversation or at some point in the conversation, point out something good about them. You know, at least you're sober. Or, well, how are you today compared to when you first came into the program? Because all we do is compete with our past selves. We don't compete with anybody else. I try to raise their self-esteem. And I have found that I can't raise your self-esteem without raising my own, too. The same way I can't resent you without resenting me. You get back what you put out. And I thought this business of raising somebody's self-esteem, I thought that's something I can do for Max. That's something I can do, show her that she's important to me. And one of the things I decided how I could do that was to make her, this sounds so silly to say it, to make her a hot cup of coffee every morning. She likes to wake up to, she hates to wake up, but when she does wake up, she likes to wake up to a hot cup of coffee. Now she doesn't like hot coffee, and she hates cold hot coffee. She likes hot coffee with 2 ice cubes that haven't melted yet. Well, she likes to see them there. I mean, if you didn't see them there, she wakes up to a problem. And she, did you put the ice cubes in this coffee? Yes, sir. So she likes to see them there. And I get up before Max does. Actually, the whole world gets up before Max does. And I go take care of Lily and Sabrina, our 2 owl dogs. And I go to my computer and I write a quick letter to God. Dear God, you're doing a good job. Keep on doing what you're doing. I'll keep on doing what I'm doing. You have a good day, and I'll have a good day, and I'll check with you tomorrow. And if I have a problem, I outline the problem. Automatic writing, typing as fast as I can. I've taught my fingers how to type. My mind stays out of it, lets my fingers type and go very fast. Don't pay attention to grammar or punctuation or anything like that. Nobody's going to read it anyhow. But I outline the problem as fast as I can. And the more I do that, the more often, before I get to the end of describing the problem, when I'm thinking about it, it's going round and round and round and round. Just keep getting bigger and bigger. It's infinite. But when I put it down in writing, it becomes finite. And before I get through writing it out, an answer will intuitively come to me as to what to do about it. And if it doesn't come while I'm typing it, it'll come, I'll awaken with it the next morning. Or it'll come to me the next day while I'm doing something else. Like that writing, automatic writing, that has really helped me a great deal. And I get intuitive answers. I've come to rely on it, as the book says. Anyway, about that time, it's time for Max to wake up. And so I go to make her coffee. And she doesn't like brewed coffee. She likes instant coffee. Well, as long as it's Yuban. Has to be Yuban. She doesn't even like the taste of coffee, really. She likes it mild. She doesn't like even a full teaspoonful, about 2/3 of a teaspoonful of Yuban. Put it in the bottom of the cup. And she doesn't like, hates cream, or milk. Doesn't use cream. Doesn't even use a milk in my, she uses a cream or powdered cream, cream or. Lots of that. Big tablespoonful of cream or. And another half a tablespoonful in. Put it in the bottom of the cup. Then you go over and you fill a cup. You don't boil the water. Take the water out of a hot water dispenser. Hot water dispenser, you have a spigot over here, and the hose goes down underneath the sink. And you have to hire a man to come, and he has to drill a hole about that big in the stainless steel sink that replaced the perfectly good white porcelain sink that was there. But you need the hot water dispenser because it dispenses water at just the right temperature for putting the 2 ice cubes in it. And as you're it's running in, you keep swishing the cup around like this so that it gets mixed up. She doesn't like it if it cakes in the bottom of the cup. And then you can't swish too hard or it'll slosh over the top of the thing. The bottom of the cup will be wet, and you don't have to do that. And you have to not fill it too full either, because you got to get 2 ice cubes in there, and you can't drop them in, you got to slide them in over there, right on the bottom. And now she's even gotten to where she likes a little whipped cream and cinnamon on top. she likes that so much, she goes to Price Club and she buys 3 quarts of whipping cream at a time. And you take that into the darkened bedroom. And you be very careful where you walk so that you don't... Those high-heeled shoes are painful. You step on those in your bare feet. And you're particularly careful going up along the side of the bed because those glossy magazines are very slippery. And when you get to the bedside stand, you don't look for a bare spot. You just look for a level spot. And then you turn around and you don't cheat. You don't cheat. You don't do anything to wake her up. You walk out hoping that she'll wake up before the ice cubes melt. Now, all of that, that's the easy part. That's the easy part. The hard part is you don't dare hope that she'll appreciate it. Because if you want her to appreciate it, then it's not love. It's not, it's barter. Duxie, you say it all the time. Love is for free and for fun. For free and for fun. Expect anything in return. It's not for the barter. Yeah, free and for fun. And I thought, God, that's a strict damn rule, if you ask me. But I have to admit right off, Max is very cooperative, so she never appreciates it. So, anyway, my time is up, and I love you all. Thanks for having a great weekend. Have a great weekend.